Bhakti Vai Bhavaki.
Grantaraja, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki
Giriraj Maharaj Ki
Jai Nitai Goprema Nandi. Good to see you. Some old faces. I was missing some of you. You know, the whole family is back together. I think. Anyone missing still? Wish you were here. So hands up if you need a course book. Sorry, I've twisted my knee, so I can't walk properly. So that's why I'm asking Jagannath Prabhu. Otherwise, I'll bring the books to you. Where else next? I see. Someone took your book. Really? Who else? You don't have it? Everyone has? Thank you. Thank you very
much. Okay. So,
so what did we discuss last week? Third canto. Summary of the third canto. Any points anyone can remember? Basically.
Creation was discussed 3 times.
Creation was discussed 3 times.
Very
deep. Yeah. Big subject matter of the third canto. Okay. We discussed so many points. Now the whole family is here. Okay. You need a book? Is anyone not here from last year? Shekhar's not here. He's not back yet? Okay. When Shekhar's back, then we'll go into Mahabharata. Then the whole family will be back together.
Nearly everyone's here.
Okay. So, tonight we'll begin the fourth canto of the Bhagavad Gita, which is very auspicious. Whenever we finish one of the cantos or begin one of the cantos, very auspicious, like that. Just get a chair for yogi, somebody get a chair. Okay. So whenever we begin one of the cantos or finish one of the cantos, it's very auspicious. There's a chair just here, I think. Spare one, please. So today is also a very auspicious day because it's the day that follows Nityananda Trayodashi, which is the most auspicious day. The appearance day of Nityananda Prabhu. And Nityananda Prabhu is the original guru. So we pray for his mercy. It's by his mercy that we're studying the Bhagavad Gita. And today is also very auspicious because today is Purnima. The Purnima is auspicious, the full moon. And today is also the appearance day of Narottama Das Thakur. Or is it the disappearance day? It's appearance. Okay, so today is the appearance day of Narottama Das Thakur, which is extremely auspicious also. So today is very auspicious, and we pray to Nityananda Prabhu, to Narottama Das Thakur, to Srila Prabhupada, to Giriraj, to all the previous acharyas for their mercy, that some fruit will bear in our study of the fourth canto of the Bhagavad Gita. And it is said that he is actually an incarnation of the Shakti of Nityananda Prabhu. Okay, so he's a very, very powerful personality. So we pray to all of our previous acharyas, our guru, Guruji Master, that by the study of the fourth canto we will get some purification and benefit, and our heart will become cleansed. Especially in the very beginning we'll begin to associate with the Lord Shiva in chapter 2, which is extremely auspicious. Okay, so we'll begin. Chapter 1, verse number 1. So, chapter 1 is called Genealogical Table of the Daughters of Manon. So, it was mentioned in the third canto that Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa had three daughters and two sons. Priyavrata and Uttanapad are the sons, and the daughters are Akuti, Devahuti and Prasuti, like that. So, Vidura asked Maitreya Muni specifically near the end of the third canto. He said, "Please tell me the pastime of the marriage between Kardama Muni and Devahuti," because he specifically wanted to hear about Lord Kapiladeva. So now, the pastimes of Lord Kapiladeva have just finished, and now Maitreya goes back to the other children of Swayambhuva Manu. And he will begin this chapter by speaking of the three daughters, Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti. But because Devahuti has already been elaborately discussed, he will briefly discuss Akuti and then go into some pastimes with Prasuti, like that. And then we will see that in the next canto, this canto and also the next canto, we'll see then the pastimes will evolve, descriptions will evolve with pastimes with Uttanapad and Priyavrata, like that, and then their descendants. And that will flow through all the way to the 10th canto, like that. We'll see as it goes down, we'll see the different descendants and different pastimes. Prahlad Maharaj will appear in the 7th canto, and then we'll go down. And then finally, Lord Rama appears in the 9th canto as a member of the Suryavams, coming from the Sun Dynasty. And in the 10th canto, then Lord Krishna appears, who is descending in the Chandravams, or the Dynasty of the Moon God. So Sri Maitreya said, "Swayambhuva Manu begot three daughters in his wife Shatarupa, and their names were Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti." That's it for you. Can you read the first paragraph?
First of all, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad Sri Shivan Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, by whose order I am engaged in this Herculean task of writing commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam as the Bhakti Vedanta purports. By His grace, we have finished three cantos already, and we are just trying to begin the fourth canto. By His divine grace, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto Lord Chaitanya, who began this Krishna consciousness movement of Bhagavata Dharma 500 years ago. And through His grace, let us offer our obeisances to the six Goswamis, and then let us offer our obeisances to Radha and Krishna, the spiritual couple who enjoy eternity in Vrindavan with their cowherd boys and dancers in Rajabhumi. Let us also offer our respectful obeisances to all the devotees and eternal providers of the Supreme Lord."
So what are the points here?
Mangalacharan.
Any other points?
First of all, we are Prabhupada giving obeisances to his spiritual master. But his answer is in the first.
Good. Any other? Yeah, specifically. Yeah, it's the aim, the mood and mission, specifically. So this is Mangal Acharan. We studied in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, and if you remember back in Canto 1, verse 1, the first three verses of the Bhagavatam, 1, 2, and 3, we discussed this as Mangalacharan. Mangalacharan means invoking auspiciousness. Before we begin any task in Krishna consciousness, we must invoke auspiciousness. Before we begin to cook an offering for the deities, before we begin to dress the deities, before we begin to make a garland, before we begin to sweep the temple room floor, before we begin to distribute books, before we begin to give a lecture, right? Before we do any service, we first pray to our guru and to our previous acharyas for their blessings. And then we perform the service with their blessings. Otherwise we feel that we are inadequate to perform the service, any service like that. So that is the mood of the devotee. So before we begin any activity, first is Mangal Acharan. It means we pray for mercy from the previous day. So Prabhupada here, showing us as the ideal acharya, as our param guru, Srila Prabhupada is showing that before he begins writing the fourth canto, first he prays for the blessings of his spiritual master. And then the previous acharyas, Mahaprabhu, Radha and Krishna. So this is how we become connected, and this is how we become empowered. Maybe that's a very powerful word. Maybe we don't get empowered. But we become connected to the disciplic succession. When we humbly offer our obeisances at the lotus feet of our spiritual master, that connects us back through the disciplic succession. And then we become connected through disciplic succession to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we become connected to Radha and Krishna. And it's by the mercy of Radha and Krishna, coming down through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, through disciplic succession, which we receive, which allows us to gain any qualification to do any service that we do. Otherwise we don't have a qualification. The qualification is not ours. It is simply the mercy we're receiving from our superiors. That is how the devotee actually feels. So Srila Prabhupada, who is Nitya Siddha, it means he's an eternal associate of the Lord. But he feels he is just an insignificant servant of his Guru Maharaj and of the disciplic succession. And that's how one becomes empowered to spread Krishna consciousness. Because Srila Prabhupada, whenever he was offered respect, or whenever credit was given to him, he said, "It is simply the mercy of my spiritual master." And we see right here in the beginning of the fourth canto, he gives all the credit to his spiritual master, to Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur. That is the key to success in Krishna consciousness. When we give all credit to our spiritual master, to our previous acharyas, to the Lord himself. Not that we consider ourselves particularly qualified like that. We have to check our own advancement, and we'll see what is our attitude when we receive some praise from another devotee. Someone offers us some praise. And do we do as Prabhupada does? Do we immediately offer the credit to our guru? Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. And do we do it sincerely and from the heart? In other words, we can do things on the external platform, meaning that someone offers us praise and externally we train ourselves to give credit to the guru. Oh, no, it's my guru's. The credit goes to my spiritual master, it's not me. Right? Someone gives us some praise and then says, no, it's my mercy of my guru. But inside, right, what are we feeling? Right? Are we actually feeling like that? Right? Or is there something we're actually still feeling? No, it is my good quality. It is my ability. It is my intelligence like that. So when you become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, then it becomes a genuine feeling in the heart. That we actually feel that we are only able to do any service because we get the mercy of our spiritual master. And by his mercy, by the disciplic succession's mercy, by Mahaprabhu's mercy, by Radha and Krishna's mercy, then we can do some seva. Okay. So this is how one becomes empowered. Now Srila Prabhupada says that writing this Bhagavatam was a Herculean task. Now you have to meditate on what Srila Prabhupada did. Right? He translated the Bhagavatam. Right? Now, he came to America in 65 with the first canto completed. Right? And then by, I think it was about 72, 73, he was only up to like canto 3 or so. So he's practically finished from canto 3 up to canto 10 in the last 3 or 4 years. And that was when ISKCON was really becoming a big society and there was a lot to manage. And in between all of that, he finished the Chaitanya Charitamrita.
One volume every day was being printed.
Being printed, yeah. And he had established by 1977 108 temples and had initiated 10,000 disciples. And over 1 million books had been distributed. More than that, by the time he'd left this world. And in between all of that, he was going to bed at 10 o'clock at night and getting up at 12 o'clock and spending 6 hours translating the Bhagavad Gita. And then managing ISKCON throughout the day and all the problems. Prabhupada said, management gives me a headache. Right? Which we all know. Managing anything gives you a headache. But Prabhupada did it. Right? So Prabhupada, he's saying here, right? By whose order? By the order of my guru, I am engaged in this Herculean task of writing the commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. It's a Herculean task. And Srila Prabhupada expected the same from his followers. Right? He expected his disciples and his grand disciples to perform Herculean tasks. That was Prabhupada's mood. That is the mood of our family acharya. Right? Not that we just do some... I mean, any service we do is appreciated by Srila Prabhupada. But he expected us to do Herculean things. Big things for Krishna. So that should be our mood. We should take inspiration from Prabhupada and we should do as much as we can to assist him in increasing the Krishna consciousness movement. Just like I was reading the other day about... it's hard for me not to get emotional when I speak about this, but I was reading about Jayapataka Swami. I mean, what an incredible personality. I mean, to be in that kind of condition and then to go and give a class for 3 or 4 hours in India, when his health is so, he's suffering so much physically and still going out and preaching and giving a 3 or 4 hour class. So this is what Prabhupada was expecting from his followers. Right? So this is the kind of mood that we have to imbibe from our founder Acharya. Right? It's not a small thing. Prabhupada was not doing a small thing. And he expected us to give that much. He expected us to give everything, our entire life, to spreading this Krishna consciousness movement. Right? I remember Tamal Krishnamurti said to us one time, he said, if everyone in this movement was surrendering as much as I am, he said, we would take over the world. Right? Not that he was putting himself on a pedestal, but he was just saying practically. If you give yourself 100% to surrendering to your spiritual master and to spreading this movement will spread and take over the world. And that was Prabhupada's desire. Prabhupada said to Burujan Prabhu, and Mother Jagatarini, he said, my desire is that every living entity in the universe goes back to Godhead. He said, please help me in this desire. Okay. So that was Prabhupada's desire. And that is the desire of our founder Acharya. So we see in the very beginning, he is humbly offering obeisances to the previous Acharyas and begging for their mercy that he can spread the Krishna consciousness movement. And when someone has that perfect service attitude, you can see what happened. One person changed this planet. Srila Prabhupada changed this planet. One person came alone on a boat to America in 1965. He got off the boat and he said, I did not know whether to turn left or to turn right. And in 12 years, the Krishna consciousness movement, which is still growing, only because his disciples and his followers are surrounding him.
On Swarnath Jayapataka Swami Maharaj, an example of his humility, I received a mail recently in that he mentioned that he was treated at Bhaktivedanta Hospital, and he says that, I know this is a very great hospital because people who become patients here, at least 50 devotees they churn out in a day. And then he goes on to say after that, that now that I have stayed in that hospital, I also hope to become a devotee. That was his statement.
Okay, so we'll read the second.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yeah.
If they pay our senses to his spiritual master and then throw him to Lord Chaitanya, and through Lord Caitanya to the sixth Goswami. So why not from through his guru to the sixth Goswami's first, and then through them to the Lord Caitanya?
Because the way I can explain it, this may be correct or not correct, but Prabhupada, this is spontaneous love. So when the love is spontaneous and pure, then it may not be like following all the precise etiquette, but it doesn't matter because Prabhupada, it's pure love.
Okay.
So even if Prabhupada may say it like that, he may not say like, but Prabhupada's just speaking. You have to understand when Prabhupada's translating this, he's somewhere in the world. He might even be up in this room here. He translated some of these cantos up here, in this room, straight above us. It's incredible. You know, some of this was actually translated up there, some of these cantos. So he's there by himself at 12 at night, 12:30, by himself, you know, just with the light on behind the desk. And he's just feeling, Prabhupada said, these purports are my personal ecstasies. So he's just speaking and his heart is flowing like that. So maybe it's not following all the... But, you know, Prabhupada's love is spontaneous, it's pure. So. Any other points?
I've read it on another occasion, I can't remember where, but he said the same thing that Prabhupada was telling to offer up 56 performance, so maybe it is actually in the etiquette, maybe there is a performance, because
yeah, it could be something in there that's like in there. Okay, I'll read the second paragraph.
It was called Canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There are 31 chapters, and all these chapters describe the secondary creation by Brahma and Nandi. The Supreme Lord himself does the real creation by agitating some pure energy, and then by his order, Brahma, the first living creature in the universe, attempts to create the different planetary systems and their inhabitants, expanding the population through his progeny, like Manu and the other progenitors of living entities, who work perpetually under the order of the Supreme Lord. In the first chapter of the fourth canto, there are descriptions of three daughters as finally the mothers and the descendants. The next six chapters describe the sacrifice performed by King Daksha and how it was spoiled. Thereafter, the activities of Maharaj Dhruva are described in five chapters. Then, in 11 chapters, the activities of King Preetus are described in the next eight chapters that are devoted to the activities of the Chaitanya King.
That's good. So what are the points here?
First creation is carried out by the Lord himself by his tabby and two engines. Very powerful as well.
Secondary creation, I feel.
What's the vision?
Defining the objective. Any other points? So if you remember when we go back to Canto 2, the 10th chapter, the first verse, which I've written up the 10 subject matters. So these are the 10 subject matters of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Sarga, Visarga, Stana, Poshana, Bhutaya, Manvantara, Isha, Anukata, Nirota, Mukti, and Ashraya. So these are the 10 subject matters of the Bhagavatam. Now these 10 subject matters, they've been covered within the Bhagavatam. Everything in the Bhagavatam is under these 10 categories. So the first is called the Sarga. The Sarga is the creation by the Lord, the first creation, the primary or the preliminary creation, the primary creation. So this creation is the creation of Mahavishnu. When Mahavishnu expands the universes from his paws and his glances, and we went into a very elaborate description of this 1 or 2 years ago, like that. And then we have the secondary creation. The secondary creation, the primary creation is Mahavishnu and then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters into each universe, and from his navel comes the lotus flower. And then Swayambhu, which means Brahma, self-born, he manifests. Now when Brahma begins to create, that is the secondary creation, that is called Visarga. Okay. So that has already been described in the second canto and in the third canto, the secondary creation, like that. Then we have Stanam. Stanam means the planetary systems. So that has also been described. The different planetary systems were created within the Virat Rupa, or the universal form. That has been described also to some extent. Then we have the Porshana. Porshana means protection or maintenance. So it means when the Lord descends himself for the purpose of protecting his devotees, such as when Varahadev came in the third canto. This is Porshana. He comes to protect his devotees, maintain religious principles. That verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskritam dharma samstapanataya, right? To re-establish religion. Sambhavami yuge yuge. So this Porshanam is the Lord's purpose for coming. To re-establish religious principles. Right? To destroy miscreants. Right? To protect the devotees. So Porshanam, what does it say? It says protection. Also, Prabhupada also says maintenance. Like that. Because Vishnu maintains. Shiva destroys. Brahma creates. Like that. Then? Uttaya. Uttaya means the creative impetus. It means the living entity populating the universe, which is what we're seeing now in these chapters. The living entities begin to populate the universe. Brahma creates Swayambhu, Manu, Shatarupa, and from there then we have so many descendants which come. Like that. Then? Manvantara. It means the different Manus. Now we're discussing Swayambhu, Manu. Like that. And then?
Isha.
Isha means? Supreme Controller. Isha Anukata means descriptions about the controller. Signs of God, like that. So it means the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj, the teachings of Lord Kapiladeva, right? All of these different subjects, the teachings of Queen Kunti. Isha Anukata, right? Great devotees describing the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his attributes, like that. And then we have Nirodha means the dissolution. Right? So that's been described also in the second canto, third canto to some degree. And mukti, receiving liberation from this material entanglement. And when the Lord gives liberation. We saw Devahuti receive liberation. We saw Kadama Muni receive liberation. Okay. And then finally, Ashraya. Ashraya means the samambodham or the shelter or the final abode. That is Krishna in the tenth canto. Right? It is Swayam Bhagavan himself. He is the Ashraya. He is the source of everything. He is the origin of everything. Ishwara Parama Krishna. Such Chit Ananda Vigraha. Anadya Adya Govinda. Sava Karana Karanam. Like that. I gave the key memory verses out. So anyone who came who wasn't here last week and asked the other devotees, they'll give you the key memory verses. Is there anything else I'd like to? The groups. Okay, can you remind me at the end of the class? We can organize the groups. Okay, so we're seeing that this fourth canto is describing which of these ten subject matters, according to what Prabhupada has just stated in the second paragraph. Yeah, but what's coming now? Manvantara, right? It's a description of Manu, Swayambhu Manu. And? Ishanakuta will be in there, yeah, because there'll be descriptions of the Lord, like that. Uttaya, yeah, creative impetus, like that, is taking place, like that. So specifically this is what's taking place now. Description of Manu and the creative impetus, how the universe is populated. And you'll see there's descriptions of all these great souls who begin to come forth to populate the universe. Okay. Okay, so we read the final paragraph. That's right. Sri Devi, can you read the last paragraph?
As described in the first verse of the chapter, Swayambhu Manu had three daughters, named Aputi, Devahuti, Prasuti. Of these three daughters, one daughter, Devahuti, has already been described, along with her husband, Kadama Muni, and her son, Kapila Muni. In this chapter, the descendants of the first daughter, Aputi, will specifically be described. Swayambhu Muni was the son of Brahma. Brahma had many other sons, but Manu's name is specifically mentioned first because he was a great devotee of the Lord. In this verse, there is also the word indicating that besides the three daughters mentioned, Swayambhu Manu also had two sons.
What are the points here?
So in the third canto that Manu was not only a great devotee but a great son also to his father.
Mm.
He was the one who agreed to help his father getting body.
Mm. So this is what qualification of the devotee. The qualification of the devotee is the loyalty to the father. Prabhupada said the spiritual master is formality. Prabhupada said actually the relationship is spiritual father. Like that. So the loyalty to one's father. In this case with Swayambhu Manu, the guru is the father. Like that. His father is his guru. Right? Lord Brahma is his father, but he's also his guru. Like that. In our circumstances, our father may be our guru or he may not be. According to the individual situation. Like that. But we are fortunate because we are dvija. And dvija means we are twice born. We took seminal birth, the first birth, from the biological father. But the second birth came from disciplic succession, from our spiritual master. So that is our actual father. Unless the father is a devotee, then we obey him also. But if the father is a non-devotee, then we may not obey him. That is permissible. But the spiritual master, one must obey. One cannot refuse the order of the spiritual master. Otherwise, one is not qualified as a disciple. Right? The qualification of the disciple is that he is 100% surrendered to his spiritual master. That is the qualification. Like that. Just like Srila Prabhupada said about Tamal Krishna Maharaj one time, he said he can walk through fire for Krishna. So that is the mood of the disciple. Right? That he will enter through fire on behalf of the spiritual master. He is fully surrendered to the guru. Like that. So this is Swayambhu Manu's qualification, and that's what makes him great. And therefore, Prabhupada is pointing out that's why he's being depicted or spoken about in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is only speaking about great personalities. The Bhagavatam is not wasting time with lesser personalities. It is the most exalted devotees who are being mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Just like we'll see in the next chapter, we'll hear all about Lord Shiva. And we'll have the opportunity to associate with Lord Shiva for 6 chapters. Right? And we'll see how much effect that will have in our consciousness. How much purification we'll get by associating with the most exalted Vaishnava. Okay. Any points? Okay. Ankuti had 2 brothers. But in spite of her brothers, King Swayambhu Manu handed her over to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of her be returned to Manu as his son. This he did in consultation with his wife, Shatarupa.
Sometimes a sonless person offers his daughter to a husband on the condition that his grandson be returned to him to be adopted as his son and inherit his property. This is called Putrika Dharma, which means that by execution of the religious rituals, one gets a son, although one is sonless by one's own wife. But here we see extraordinary behavior in Manu, for in spite of having 2 sons, he handed over his first daughter to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of his daughter be returned to him as his son. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur comments in this connection that King Manu knew that the Supreme Personality of Godhead would take birth in the womb of Prakriti. Therefore, in spite of having two sons, he wanted that the particular son born of Prakriti, because he was ambitious to have the Supreme Personality of Godhead appear as his son and grandson. Manu is the lawgiver of mankind, and since he personally executed the Tuttika Dharma, we may accept that such a system may be adopted by mankind also. Thus, even though one has a son, if one wants to have a particular son from one's daughter, one may give one's daughter in charity on that condition. That is the opinion of Srila Jiva Goswami.
Mm. What are the points here?
You see, Satya Lavadi on the fire, trying to grieve for the Lord. But apparently, it looks like the material is what it's done.
He desires to get the association of Krishna. Any other points?
I was wondering why this. Why Manu didn't put the same condition with Kadamu?
Not sure. Good question, but I'm not sure. So, any other points?
Arjuna also gave a son to the father-in-law as well, one who has...
Arjuna?
Mm, I said that wrong, actually, before my son. After, I think he put after him, Mary and got a son from the other princess, he married to some other as well. But that was not the one who was there, he was some other one.
Yeah, I think you're right. When he was travelling for that 1 year. So this is called Putrika Dharma. So Dharma means the codes which must be followed by humankind to make elevation in Krishna consciousness. The defect in modern society is that Dharma has been lost. Society must follow Dharma in order to elevate itself. Right? So therefore in the sixth canto, Yamaraj mentions there are 12 Mahajanas. And he says that they are the knowers of Dharma or religion. And by following the codes or their teachings, one becomes elevated. Human society becomes elevated. Right? Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Narada, Kapila, Manu, right? The Kumaras, Janaka, Bhishma, Prahlad, Bali, Shukadev, and Yamaraj himself. Right, so by following these personalities, one becomes elevated. Now, Manu is the father of mankind. He has one shastra called Manu Samhita, which is very important. In this Manu Samhita, there are all the instructions how human society should live. And by following those injunctions, human society becomes purified and elevated in consciousness. So this is one of the injunctions, right? That the father may give the daughter in charity, right, with the condition that the son born will come back to him. Usually he will do this. It's not whimsical. These things are not whimsical. Mm. Usually he will do this if he does not have a son and he needs to continue the dynasty. So it's not a whimsical thing. It's an important thing. And these things will generally happen amongst the higher classes, like the Kshatriyas, the kings and so forth. So these things are permissible like that. The problem is that now in Kali Yuga everything is contaminated and everything is useless. Like that, everything's fallen apart. Dharma is not followed anymore. People are not following religious codes. You know, everyone—it's all become contaminated and chaotic.
Hodgepodge.
Yeah. In Kali Yuga, everything has become upside down, practically speaking. But previously, these things were there. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu mentions in his conversation with the Chankazi in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, mentions the five things are forbidden within Kali Yuga. One should not take sannyas. One should not perform a horse sacrifice. One should not perform a cow sacrifice. One should not beget a child in the womb of his brother's wife. And what is the other one?
Not offer meat sacrifice.
Do not offer. Yeah, means and sannyas. Is it? Is it? Is that the fifth one? Okay. I thought it was something else. If I remember. But these are the five things which are forbidden within Kali Yuga, like that. So it means within Kali Yuga, these things which were previously acceptable, certain things are forbidden now because everything will become misused. Like that. It's not, there's not pure society. Right? People were corrupted now, and they will take advantage of things, and they will manipulate things, and they will, how do you say it? They will disturb, yeah, but they will like take advantage, what's the word?
Exploit
things, yeah. People will exploit things in this age. All these things they will exploit, because they're not pure in their motive. Whereas previously their souls were very exalted and are very pure, and they could do these things, but there was no contamination to their consciousness. So Swayambhuva Manu, he set this rule. So in this particular point, he said, you must give me the child back. Now Prabhupada points out in the purport, he already had two sons. So there was not really a necessity for him to ask for the child back. But he knew this particular child was Jagya. And Jagya means he was an incarnation of Vishnu. So he said, please give him back. Because he wanted to have the Lord's association. Now, that was his pure motive, like that. And what was this sage's name who gave him back?
Ruchi.
So the qualification of Ruchi was that he obeyed the senior. Now that's one of the important points of Vedic culture, right? Vedic culture is based on obedience to the superiors, right? As soon as you break, and that's why Kali Yuga is, that's the main problem in Kali Yuga. No obedience to the superiors. Prabhupada points out in the Gita, one will not even offer a verbal argument to the superior. But these days in Kali Yuga, it's just that's nothing like that is practiced. Everything has become so contaminated, and now everything is lost. Right? But Vedic culture is based upon one must follow the superior. Even one may not personally like it, but by following that, he becomes perfect. Right? Just like you see in the Mahabharata, it's full of these examples, great examples. Just like Karna. Right? Karna was approached by Indra before the battle. Indra took the form of a Brahmana and came to Karna. And Karna looked at him, right? And this Brahmana said, I would like to beg some charity from you. And Karna said, take whatever you like. He said, I would like your armor and your earrings. So Karna took his knife, his sword, and removed and gave it to him. Like that. That is Dharma. So it was so strict, so powerful. Yeah. Like that. Even Jarasandha, when Krishna and Bhima and Arjuna came to him, right, and they said, we are Brahmanas, please give us some charity. And he looked at them and he said, I don't think you are Brahmanas. Right? Because they all had a... where they carry their bows, and they had like the indentation of the bow in their shoulder. So he looked at them and he said, you're not Brahmanas. So he said, anyway, you're dressed as Brahmanas, what do you want? And they said, we want to fight. Like that. So he said, okay, let's go. Okay. So this is Vedic culture. This is how perfect it was previously. That's why Prabhupada, it is actually, Rupa Goswami mentions in the Nectar of Devotion, he says, one should not take a vow before the deity. Right? Kali Yuga is very dangerous. People taking vows in Kali Yuga, it's very hard for us to keep vows in Kali Yuga. Right? Previously, if someone made a vow, that was, it was a vow, it was in stone. Different now. You know, people say things, but hands up if you've never told a lie in your life. That's Kali Yuga. It actually happened previously, in previous times. Hands up if you haven't told a lie in the last week. Since the last class that we had 1 week ago. Hands up, you didn't tell a lie. Okay, last week. Okay, probably one person put their hand up. This is Kali Yuga. Very dangerous. Previously, it was very powerful. Right? This Vedic culture, people were so powerful. Right? If they took vows, it actually meant something. Like that. So Ruchi, he was asked by his superior. Right? The superior said, please give the son. And immediately, for someone that's given like that. And that is Vedic culture, and that's how one makes advancement in spiritual life. One obeys the superiors. Right? One obeys one's superior personality, and one maintains his vows.
Okay. Also in Gita, Krishna himself says austerity of the body, mind and words. Austerity of the body consists of speaking with austerities of the body consists of Deva Dvija Guru Pragna Pujanam Shalcham Arjanam Namasari Manin Sharyam Naposati. That means like one should respect the Supreme Lord, Brahmanas, Dvija, Deva Dvija Guru Pragna, all these teachings.
Then
that should be, they should be given
utmost
respect and worship.
Like. A perfect culture. Okay. So read verse 3. Ruchi, who was very powerful in his Brahminical qualifications and was appointed one of the progenitors of the living entities, begot one son and one daughter by his wife, Akuti. Usha, can you read that?
The word Brahma, Vachasvi, is very significant. Ruchi was a Brahmana and he executed the Brahminical duties very rigidly. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, the Brahminical qualifications are control of the senses, control of the mind, cleanliness within and without, development of spiritual and material knowledge, simplicity, truthfulness, faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, etc. There are many qualities which indicate a Brahminical personality, and it is understood that Ruchi followed all the Brahminical principles rigidly. Therefore, he is specifically mentioned as a Brahma Vachasri. One who is born of a Brahmana father but does not act as a Brahmana is called, in Vedic language, a Brahma Bandhu, and is calculated to be on the level of Shudras and women. Thus, in the Bhagavatam, we find that Mahabharata was specifically compiled with Vyasadeva for Sri Shudra Brahma Bandhu. Sri means women, Shudra means the lower class of civilized human society, and Brahma Bandhu means persons who are born in the families of Brahmanas but do not follow the rules and regulations carefully. All of these three classes are called less intelligent. They have no access to the study of the Vedas, which are specifically meant for persons who have acquired the Brahminical qualifications. This restriction is based not upon any sectarian distinction but upon qualification. The Vedic literatures cannot be understood unless one has developed the Brahminical qualifications. It is regrettable, therefore, that persons who have no Brahminical qualifications and have never been trained under the bona fide spiritual master nevertheless comment on Vedic literatures like the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Puranas, for such persons cannot deliver their real message. Ruchi was considered a first-class Brahmana. Therefore, he is mentioned here as a Brahma Vachasvi, one who had full prowess in Brahminical strength.
What are the points here?
Talking about the qualifications of a true Brahmana, as against a Brahma Bandhu and a Brahma Vachasvi. Srila Prabhupada is highlighting that the most important qualification is control of mind and senses.
Good.
People who don't have Brahminical qualifications and never been trained, we give comments on Vedic literature, like Srimad Bhagavatam.
And there's no benefit hearing from them.
We have practiced by the lips of a serpent.
Alright,
I wanted to ask about this where it says Vyasadeva Ji compiled Mahabharata for Sri Shudra Brahma Bandhu. Part of which of Mahabharata is obviously Bhagavad Gita, which was so why specifically talking about targeting to talk about only specific people like Sri Shudra and Brahma.
For the Mahabharata. Yeah. Okay. We'll answer that. Okay. Any other points?
You mentioned that Ruchi followed rigidly those regulations. Now, this time we heard that now the higher, the lower can be discounted for higher principles. So, and if you're focusing too much on the principle, you miss out the thought.
If we didn't have a time to perform certain activity in the morning, for example, now everything can be just disrupted. But in focusing the higher principle, we can discover it. So, we will be there.
The point that Prabhupada makes in this purport is that the Vedic literatures cannot be understood unless one has developed Brahminical qualifications. So that means Krishna specifically says in the Gita, Samo Damas Tapaha Socham Shanti Ajavam Evacha Jnanam Vijnanam Ashtikam Brahma Karma Svabhavajam. So Brahma Karma. Karma means the way they act, their activities.
Quality.
You'll notice, yeah, specifically their qualities.
For other Brahmanas, the activities are more, especially for Brahmanas, qualities are very important.
You'll see in the Gita, when Krishna mentions in the 18th chapter, when he discusses the Shudras, the Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas, he mentions what they do. Right? As opposed, the Kshatriyas, the qualities somewhat, but what they do, whereas the Brahmanas, it's the qualities. One must develop Brahminical qualities in order to study the Vedas. Right? Because one needs those qualities in order to imbibe the Vedic knowledge and to realize the Vedic knowledge. Right? To practice the Vedic knowledge. So therefore, one needs to develop Brahminical quality. Now Brahminical quality, as Prabhupada points out, it is received by training. And that's why one becomes Dvija. Dvija means twice born. Kalo, Sudro, Sambhav. Means that everyone in Kali Yuga is born Shudra. Sudra means we don't have training. That's what it means. When we grow up, we don't have proper training. We're not given proper training. Right? When you grow up in India, you get some proper training. Because of the culture, the heritage, which is there, because your parents, your grandparents, they train you in certain things which are proper. Right? You need that training in order to become qualified as a human being, as an Aryan, as a civilized person. Even in the West, we get training. Our parents teach us good manners and certain things. But one needs to receive complete training or proper training from a guru. You know? One needs a spiritual master. So therefore, in order to become qualified as a human being, one needs to be twice born, which means one needs to get training from a spiritual master and the spiritual master's representatives. Right? Our Diksha Guru, our Shiksha Gurus, and the senior Vaishnavas. They will train us and qualify us and train us to develop the Brahminical qualifications. They'll purify us by their association. So that we can then begin to understand the Vedic literatures. You can read the Bhagavatam, but if you read the Bhagavatam by yourself, you will only make a certain amount of advancement as a devotee. You need regular interaction with more advanced devotees, because when you regularly interact with more advanced devotees, they will purify you of your anathas. And that purification becomes your qualification to actually understand the Bhagavatam. Otherwise, if we read the Bhagavatam by ourselves, we'll get some realizations. But when we're interacting with the devotees on a regular basis, then we'll become more purified. Right? And they will train us in so many things. Just like last week, I walked into the back of the Brahmachari Ashram, and one devotee was standing there in the backyard, and he was eating some prasadam. I said, "What are you doing? Right? You don't take prasadam wearing shoes, for a start." It says in Shastra, it's aparad, it's an offense to it. Take off your shoes and sit down. It's also an offense to eat standing up. Right? So I said, sit down, take off your shoes and eat prasadam properly. That's training. Right? You'll see like Saturday night at the temple, you know, Mahaprasad will come out at 7 o'clock and everyone will sit around the courtyard there standing up with their shoes on eating. It's not proper. It's not honouring prasad. It's not respectful to prasad. It's against etiquette. So therefore, we require training. Right? So we have to associate with senior devotees, and it becomes the responsibility of the devotees. When you stay in ISKCON for a number of years and you become more senior by the end of your years in ISKCON, and it then becomes your responsibility to train others. Right? Too often we see devotees, they'll see some other devotee doing something wrong and they won't correct them. Just like you'll see, like, the devotees sometimes they'll serve prasad and they'll touch the serving spoon to the plate. Right? Then the serving spoon becomes contaminated and no one says anything. Right? It's your responsibility. Every devotee's responsibility is to say Prabhu or Madhiji, right? Be careful not to touch the spoon to the plate when you serve prasad. Right? It's not so difficult to do. But people have to train. So we need this brahminical qualification. Right? Then we can understand the Vedas. Right? So one of the qualifications of the brahmanas is solchan, suci. Right? Because unless you're clean, right, then you cannot become brahminical, you cannot become purified, you cannot become qualified. And then you can understand the Vedas. My spiritual master, he taught me so many things about cleanliness. So many mistakes I made. Yeah. I had whole pastimes with him. Yeah, you need the qualification. Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, I remember one time I was in New Govardhan with my spiritual master and he said he wanted to read. So he said, get a table for me so I can read. So I went and I found a trestle table at the back and then I brought it and I set it up so he could read. And he was just looking at the table. And I was looking at him and he was looking at the table. And he said, what do people usually do on tables? And I looked at him and I said, eat? And he said, yes. So he said, so how can I read on the table? Right, so then we had to go and get a woolen chadar. Actually, I think he went and got the chadar and put the woolen chadar and then he put the shastra on the table. That's training. That's qualification. So if we don't get trained by senior bystanders, we don't become qualified and we don't get qualification and we cannot enter deeply into the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the system. You require training. And you must become qualified so then you can train others. It is your responsibility. It's a defect, it's a fault on your behalf if you see a younger devotee or another devotee committing some defect. If there's some defect there, you know, like I said about touching, and you don't do anything, then that's your defect. Right? So then you are lacking qualification.
But then the confusion also accept in the right moment.
Yeah, so then you have to see. You know, that also becomes part of Vaishnava etiquette. The way you say it and the way they
say
it.
Yeah,
all those things.
Are
yeah. All those, it becomes intricate. I know it's an intricate thing. But the point... Yeah, it's got to be a fact. Oh, sorry, yeah, tap. Yeah, it's true. It's got to be... All these things, there's a lot of intricacies in all of this. But the point is, that we're making in general, one needs training. Right? Now, Prabhupada says that the Mahabharat is specifically for the three... Shudra and Brahma Bandhu. It means that people in the age of Kali are not qualified. Right? Mahabharat is a scripture which is specifically for the residents of the age of Kali because they are not qualified. Because the Mahabharat is very easy to imbibe. Right? Mahabharat is very easy to absorb yourself in because it's very exciting. Right? It's the greatest adventure story of all time. It's the most amazing pastime. So it's very easy for people in Kali Yuga to become attracted to that. Now, if you were just given the Upanishads to study in Kali Yuga, right, you'd be find it very difficult to keep your attention. But within the Mahabharata, you learn so many intricacies about Dharma, right? And then within the entire Mahabharata, you have the association of pure devotees, the Pandavas, who specifically came empowered by Krishna to purify the earth. This is mentioned in the Chaitanya Bhagavat by Vrindavan Das Thakur. The Pandavas, they purified the earth. Just like just above Australia, we have Bali. Right, just above Australia. Now that's a long way from India. But if you go to Bali, my brother went there, and he told me that when he got off the plane, and they drove out of the airport, There's a 20-foot high statue of Krishna and Arjuna riding on a chariot. Why is that there in Bali? Because Bhimasen, when he was doing the collecting like funds for the Rajasuya sacrifice, or the Ashwamedha Yajna for Yudhishthira, he travelled all the way down to like near Bali, Indonesia. That's why Vedic culture there's something there like that. So the Pandavas, by their association, would become purified. And then Krishna himself appears within the Mahabharata. Right? And then Krishna speaks the jewel of the Mahabharata, which is the Gita. Right? So within the Mahabharata, everyone's so excited and everyone's all their attention is captivated. And then when you get to the point where the battle's just about to begin, after so much intrigue and so forth, then Krishna gives you the jewel of the Bhagavad Gita. Only 700 verses. Whereas, you know, it's hard for people to accept a lot of philosophy and Kali Yuga. So.
This my point about the women, Shudras and the Brahmavalis are not qualified to actually understand the Vedic literature. So is Vyasadeva making the point that despite the Brahmini, the training given to the women, they cannot come to the class of Brahmanas?
It's like a generic kind of a statement. It's a generic kind of a thing. That, you know, women may have been considered maybe, you know, maybe less intelligent as a class. Just like Devahuti says in that previous section in the third canto, she says to Kapila when he's teaching her, and she says, I am just a woman. I'm simple. They're simple by nature. Women are simple by nature. I'm just a woman. I can't understand so much. Just speak to me very simply. Right? And then educate me about how to perfect my own life. So as a class, women are like that. It's not a defect. It's just their nature. They're more simple. It's actually an advantage. Prabhupada says in the end of the Krishna book, he said it's easier for women to become, just like if you go to Jaipur, right, you go to Radha Govinda's mandir, right, who's in front of the altar? Right? All the Madhijis. Right? Because Prabhupada says they're just naturally attracted to Krishna. Yeah, the men have to read the whole Upanishads and the Vedanta Sutra and everything, and then, you know, is he really God or isn't he God? And yeah, the women are just like, he's so beautiful, he must be the Supreme Absolute Truth, like that. So there's advantages there. But they're more simple as a class, in general. In Kali Yuga, the differences become less, like that. I know women in Kali Yuga are far more intelligent than men.
In the story
probably most men in Kali Yuga.
In the Krishna book, the story writes of Brahmana.
Yeah, you see that pass on the Jaggi Brahmanas. Right? The Brahmanas, the men, the Brahmanas, they could not get Krishna's mercy. The wives got Krishna's mercy. So. There's not a disco. Prabhupada says in his purports, I can't remember exactly where, but Prabhupada says that the male form is meant for self-realization. There are advantages to having a male form. Right. But there are advantages to having a female form. So it's, the point is just go back to Godhead. Whatever form you've got. Yeah, just go back. If you're a woman or a man, it doesn't really matter.
Actually, this what they mention is for the like ordinary women in the material world. The Queen Kunti is so exalted personality. For her, this doesn't apply for the great devotees. That's why Krishna says also in Gita that Mamhi Partha Vipa Shrite Yeti Sri Papa Yavaha Priyo Vaishya Sutra Shrita Seti Yanti Parangati. Those who take Shatan, though they be of them, birth, and then Vaishya Shrita, still they can attain the same destination. As long as they become devotee of the Lord. Like that.
That's the point. Just like we see in Canto 1, when Krishna was leaving Hastinapur to go back to Dwarka, then all the members of the Kaurava dynasty, then all the women went onto the roof, and they were all looking at him, they're throwing flowers on him, and he was looking up at all of them, right? And Prabhupada said they all attained perfection, right? Even though they couldn't come down and be next to him because of social etiquette, but they all attained perfection because Bhakti was there. And who are the highest devotees in creation? It's the gopis. There's no disqualification. Male or female is irrelevant. Right?
Somebody actually, one of the Matas asked Prabhupada that usually I hear that the men are very disturbing, that's true. you think you are a man? Yes, then it's not possible like this. Yes, if you think that you are a man, then that is disqualification.
Therefore, Mahaprabhu says, I'm not a Brahmana, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not like that. So we must understand that is bhakti. Bhakti is based on the soul's relationship with Krishna. So it's important. Okay. Of the two children born of Akuti, the male child was directly an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and his name was Yajna, which is another name of Lord Vishnu. The female child was a partial incarnation of Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, the eternal consort of Lord Vishnu. So the two personalities were born, Yajna and Dakshina, like that. So the male child was the Lord himself, and the female child was a partial expansion of Lakshmi. Okay. Swayambhuva Manu very gladly brought home the beautiful boy named Yajna, and Ruchi, his son-in-law, kept with him the daughter Dakshina. The lord of the ritualistic performance of Yajna later married Dakshina, who was anxious to have the Supreme Personality of Godhead as her husband. And in this wife, the Lord was also very much pleased to beget 12 children. So, Jamuna Lila, can you read that purport? Now listen carefully to this purport. If you're married, listen carefully to this purport.
An ideal husband and wife are generally called Lakshmi Narayan to compare them to the Lord and the goddess of fortune. For it is significant that Lakshmi Narayan are forever happy as husband and wife. A wife should always remain satisfied with her husband, and the husband should always remain satisfied with his wife. In the Chanakya Shloka, the moral or instructions of Chanakya Pandit, it is said that if a husband and wife are always satisfied with one another, then the goddess of fortune automatically comes. In other words, where there is no disagreement between husband and wife, all material opulence is present and good children are born. Generally, according to Vedic civilization, the wife is trained to be satisfied in all conditions, and the husband, according to Vedic instruction, is required to please the wife with sufficient food, ornaments and clothing. Then if they are satisfied with their mutual dealings, good children are born. In this way, the entire world can become peaceful, but unfortunately in this age of Kali, there are no ideal husbands and wives. Therefore, unwanted children are produced, and there is no peace and prosperity in the present day world.
Srila Prabhupada ki. So Prabhupada says that the husband and wife are meant to live without disagreement. So how is this possible? How is this possible?
If they are devotees.
Yeah, if they're devotees, it requires training. It requires training. That's how it happens. Right? Because the women are trained so well. Now who was the perfect husband and the perfect wife? Devahuti and Kavana. Right, we already studied that very intricately last year. Devahuti was so well trained. And Kavana was so well trained. Right? And they were such auspicious personalities, they had a perfect marriage. Right? And that is why our marriages are not perfect, because the husband is not trained properly, or he's not accepted proper training, and the wife has not been trained properly, and therefore we have defects in our character. And because of our defects, then there are discrepancies in the marriage. But if we are trained properly, and as Srila Prabhupada points out, it doesn't matter how you begin the race, it is how you finish the race. So even if we have defects in our life, from our life so far, then that can be rectified to a great degree by the training we receive from our guru and from our shikshas. The Shiksha Gurus, those who give us shelter. Right? So the women can become purified, the men can become purified. And what is the result? Prabhupada says, they become peaceful. You know that the marriage is working and the marriage is peaceful. Generally, the first 7 years of marriage, there will be troubles like that. That's unless you're Devahuti and Kadamamuni. You're fine the first 7 years. After the first 7 years, things begin to rectify to a certain degree. And then things become more peaceful. And you realise that things are working when things are peaceful. Right? It shouldn't be that there's so much disturbance in the mind all the time. The husband is disturbed by the wife is disturbed by the husband. It's not auspicious like that. The reason that's happening is because we are disqualified. But when we become more purified, then we can live in such a way that the husband and wife, they will live peacefully together. Right? That's auspicious. And then Prabhupada says, it says in the Vedas, that Lakshmi will reside in the house where the husband and wife do not quarrel. Chanakya says like that. So this is the way to make the home life auspicious, the grihastha ashram auspicious. If the husband and wife are getting on properly, then everything becomes very auspicious. And naturally everything will just come. And then one will have good children. Right? If the husband and wife are genuinely affectionate to each other and love each other, right, then you will have good children. And the family unit will be very strong. And when the family unit is strong, then society becomes strong. Mm. And that's why the actual reason, there's many reasons, but one of the principal reasons why the Kali Yuga is so chaotic is because the family units are so dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, look at my own family. It's totally dysfunctional. Okay. My only hope is that I'm connected to ISKCON. Like that. Otherwise, it's like, I mean, this is my family here. Because this is not dysfunctional. And what's Prabhupada talking about here? He's talking about peace. Right? When I come to this classroom, peaceful. Right? This is what Prabhupada is talking about. This is our hope. Like that. So, if we can develop, by following the instructions of the Bhagavatam, if we can develop a peaceful family life, then the family becomes very strong, right? And then the whole society becomes strong. So we have a microcosmic society, international society for Krishna consciousness. Right? The rest of the world, they can do what they want. At least this society should be peaceful and everything should be getting along nicely as much as possible. Prabhupada said that if the devotees chant Hare Krishna and do kirtan together in front of the deities, he said the temple becomes like Satya Yuga. You walk in here and it's not like out there. You know, you walk out there, it's a different thing. But when you come here, it's a different atmosphere. And why is that? You know, because they're following what is taught in Prabhupada's books. Okay.
Why did you say specifically 7 years?
I read it in a book.
Which one?
I can't remember. It might have been men are from Mars and women are from Venus. I can't remember. Okay. But I also experienced that.
Okay.
First 7 years, then... You know, you try to change each other a lot because you know you think you know.
That's how long it takes for every cell to be changed in the body.
Then after that, then you're a different person.
Actually,
I don't know. I read it in a book and then it happened. So then I thought, well, obviously they knew what they were talking about. Okay. I don't know why.
Good question.
Very good.
In other words, when there is no disagreement between husband and wife, all material opulence is present. So what is talking more about satisfaction here? If they are satisfied, it doesn't matter how much they have, but they are satisfied. So it's like opulence there.
Like that, or it means all the material necessities will be met.
Yes, but that doesn't mean satisfaction, whatever they have.
Yeah. Yeah, opulence doesn't mean they'll be rich. They may be or they may not be. But it means all their material necessities will be met. It means they won't be without anything.
Yeah.
That's the point. When Lakshmi is in the home, Lakshmi means Radharani. Right? When Lakshmi is in the home, then there's nothing lacking. And no one is poor, no one is hungry, there's no anxiety. That's the point. Kali Yuga is so difficult. Okay. The 12 boys born of Jagya and Dakshina were named Tosha, Pratosha, Santosha, Bhadra, Shanti, Idaspati, Idma, Kavi, Vipu, Swana, Sudeva and Rochana. During the time of Swayambhuva Manu, these sons all became the demigods, collectively named the Tushitas. Marichi became the head of the seven rishis and Jagya became the king of the demigods, Indra. So Prabhupada points out in the purport that progeny is meant to be taught to follow the Sanatana Dharma. This is the purpose of having children. The Bhagavatam says, do not become a father, a mother, a husband, a guru, a teacher, a brahmana, right, a demigod, unless you can deliver your dependents from the cycle of birth and death. That is the point of becoming a parent. Right? Otherwise, do not have children. Right? If you want children, then you must deliver them from the cycle of birth and death. That is your responsibility. You must teach them Sanatana Dharma. That's what these great personalities are doing. They're having so many children. 12 sons. Right? Imagine having 12 sons. But they did it. They had big families, right? But they delivered the children from the cycle of birth and death. They taught them Sanatana Dharma. They taught them devotional service. This is the responsibility. Right? Bhagavatam says, do not become a husband. Do not become a father. Do not become a mother. Do not become a guru. Do not become a brahmana. Do not become a demigod. Unless a teacher. Unless you can deliver your disciples, your followers, your dependents. Right? Otherwise, you don't have qualification. Okay. Okay. Swayambhuva's Manu's two sons, Priyavrata and Uttanapad, became very powerful kings, and their sons and grandsons spread all over the three worlds during that period. My dear son, Swayambhuva Manu handed over his very dear daughter Devahuti to Kartika Muni. I've already spoken to you about them, and you have heard about them almost in full. Swayambhuva Manu handed over his daughter Prasuti to the son of Brahma named Daksha, who was also one of the progenitors of the living entities. The descendants of Daksha are spread throughout the three worlds. You have already been informed about the nine daughters of Kardama Muni, who were handed over to nine different sages. I shall now describe the descendants of those nine daughters. Please hear from me. Kardama Muni's daughter, Kala, who was married to Marichi, gave birth to two children, whose names were Kashyapa and Purnima. Their descendants are spread all over the world. My dear Vidura, of the two sons, Kashyapa and Purnima, Purnima begot three children, namely Viraja, Vishwaga, Devakulya. Of these three, Devakulya was the water which washed the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, and which later on transformed into the Ganges on the heavenly planets. So in the next several cantos, the Bhagavatam will describe these personalities in more detail. So we'll stop there for tonight, and tomorrow night, I'm not sure how many verses we'll do, but we may go up to about verse 46, because there's a lot of verses that are just without purports, just the history of this personality. So if you read ahead, then we'll probably go to up to 46, somewhere like that. Srila Prabhupada.